Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to another excellent episode of Cypherpunk. Today, we have another special guest coming from another project that has been in heavy development. We've all been hearing about it, following it a little bit. It has matured. It is really an impressive little system, and this system is called Voucher Safe. Voucher Dev, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show and welcome. There are so many developments happening right now between open transactions, Voucher Safe, Loom, the True Ledger, Bitcoin, all these systems and the whole ecosystems that's coming up and around. There's been not too much talk by some people on the Voucher Safe system. Why don't you tell us what it is?
Well, the Voucher Safe system is just simply a way of taking an asset type which is not normally in a digital form and allowing it to circulate through a payment system as digital cash. And so it has a lot of the advantages of paying someone in cash, such as an anonymity and untraceability. But it also is based on P2P technology, so it's sort of it's not really a payment system in the same sense that the first generation DGCs were payment systems. I mean, things like eGold, 1MDC, Pecunix, Gold Money, etc. It's a next generation payment system that's based on person to person. So it's more like, if it makes any sense, face to face on the internet. I mean, of course, if you're on the internet, you're not face to face, it's based around the idea of one person paying another.
Right.
And so it's as opposed to interfacing with a website or doing something along those lines. And so, as I said, it has some of the same advantages of digital cash, but it's also has the same limitations in that if you walk into a store and somebody, or you go to a store and you're planning to pay with cash, and you arrive at 6 and the store closed at 5, you go, oh, drag, I have to come back tomorrow. Because the storekeeper isn't there to take your cash and write your receipt. Right. And this is almost like that, in that there's a payment is actually a two-phase process, so that you make a payment to someone and they have to pick it up. So it isn't like you can, make a payment on a website with a credit card and it just sort of goes through a gateway. Right. Your recipient actually has to be an active participant in the transaction.
Okay.
And you get to specify up to a week that they have to pick it up. So they don't literally have to be logged in at the same moment that you do. But it works in the same basic way. You make a payment to someone. And then they pick the payment up, and a receipt is generated to, and sent back to you, which is your proof, because it's signed with their private key, is your proof that they actually got your payment.
Okay. One little thing I know that is very specific to this system, very special, and open, fellow traveler mentioned this inside the open transactions interview. One thing that he really loved about the system was that there were no accounts. It's not like you have an account on a server. You have basically your wallet, and you run running locally on your client side, and you issue these vouchers, and they transfer among a system to get to the user, but ultimately there's no account. There's just these vouchers being transferred all over the place. So it's like if you thought of Pecunix as an account-based system where transaction, where you tell the server, you know, give this much, send this much money to this account ID, and it took care of that. In this system, there's no accounts. So it takes a lot of it starts to distribute some of the liability of the server operators in a different way. But we're going to get into that a little bit later. Let me ask about you. Now, you've been involved with software development now for, I guess, around 25 years. And did you have experience doing punch cards?
No, although we did have optical mark readers when I was going through school, and actually did code, you know, put stuff through on a card deck. So I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
No, it's I've worked in areas like CAD/CAM, and even did some interactive television at one point. And so I do have experience with doing distributed systems that are real time.
Oh, okay.
And real time multi-threaded computing is just sort of its own kind of a discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not quite the same thing as, you know, writing middleware for a website processor. Right. Although I've done that, a payment processor. Although I've done that kind of work as well. But getting to what you were saying about no accounts. It is true that there is no actual account. You have what's called a voucher safe. And a voucher safe is really just an ID to which are appended some numbers, so that if you put in bill, you know, there's bill 12345 and there's bill 23456, so that you can just, you know, differentiate or disambiguate, as they say, between bills. But you have an ID that is really just an ID that indexes your public key on a public key server. And so what your voucher safe really is it's a key pair and a bunch of hashes and some other data that's used to identify folders in the data store. And you don't have an account as such. You do have receipts that you can store or get rid of as you choose, that will show you, you know, all your incoming and outgoing transactions, and you have no obligation to keep those. You can just get rid of them if you want to. So you do have some kind of a history that you can use. But there isn't an account, and this system was designed by, I mean, I also have some experience in the DGC world, and this system was designed by people who were veterans of that experience and saw firsthand what had happened with the Generation 1 payment systems such as right. eGold and 1MDC and so on. And basically what happened to those people is that they were held responsible for the actions of their customers. And they were held responsible for, if something bad was done by one of their customers, they were held responsible for not having prevented it.
Yeah.
And this is because they actually had, they had an account-based system, and they had the ability, in theory, to know, you know, to supervise or be aware of what their customers were doing.
Right.
And this doesn't make any sense if you're thinking about digital cash, because I mean, we've all heard those rumors that, you know, some substantial percentage of $100 bills have traces of cocaine on them or what have you. And that, you know, maybe cash has been used for some illicit transaction somewhere along the way in the history of that bill. But the fact is, there's no way to know that. When the Bureau of Engraving and Printing puts bills into circulation, and they're, you know, someone cashes a check or uses an ATM machine or whatever, and then the bill gets into circulation, it then circulates in the wild, and no one has any idea, you know, what that is actually used for.
Right. Yeah.
And so our thinking is, go ahead.
I was just going to say that in this example, it's absurd to think that banks would be somehow criminally liable for what users do with their cash that they have, like, pulled out from cashing their check from their payroll check on a Friday, and they go out and do something stupid on a Saturday and wind up in prison. They don't go after the bank for
exactly
to be liable in any way for those activities.
Sure. The bank is only liable for the payments that it approves, you know, for the payments that actually take place in the bank. If somebody writes a forged check, for example, the bank could have some liability there. But they don't have any liability for what goes on with cash that's circulating in the wild. And similarly, the mint, you know, nobody goes to the master of the mint, the head of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and says, hey, some of your $100 bills were used in a drug deal, so we're going to arrest you.
Right.
Well, first of all, he or she is a government official, and that sort of law isn't likely to be enforced on them in the first place. But even if it were, I mean, you'd go to court and you wouldn't be able to prove any kind of liability, right? So, because how could the person have known what these bills were? I mean, they're not psychic. You know, there's no way they could know that. So our thinking was that one of the things you have to do, not just to protect the users, but to also protect the operators of a system, which is certainly equally important, because no matter how much the users like the system, if the system doesn't stick around, as Eagle didn't stick around, then it doesn't do the users any good in the end.
Right.
So we also have to think about protecting the operators. And one of the best ways to protect the operators, to make it impossible for the operator to know exactly what is going on. And this is not only a necessity as far as protecting the operator is concerned, but it also solves another problem, which is very, very vexing for any kind of an internet payment system, and that is, how do you know who you can trust? If you have to give some kind of credentials, login, account information, whatever, to a website, how do you know that website isn't going to get hacked? How do you know that the people who are running it are honest? How do you know that your records or your personal data are not going to get used against you, and you're not going to get blindsided by something down the road?
Yeah, look, at last past it, 2 weeks ago, Sony got their servers hacked into, and I think around 6 million credit cards or something got exposed.
This seems to happen every couple of months. It's sort of like every couple of months there's a record drug bust or something, and after 90 years, this is supposed to be progress. You simply can't create a giant jackpot full of people's personal data, their credit cards, you know, anything they'd need to, someone would need to do identity theft, and expect that jackpot is not going to be stolen at some point by someone. It's just, you just sort of have to take that as read. So what if you had a payment system where there weren't accounts, and what if it was impossible, even if somebody who did, you know, did manage to hack into a voucher publisher, there wouldn't be any data there? The only thing that would happen is that there'd be a temporary glitch in the, you know, in the server. Maybe you wouldn't be able to make payments for a day or something. I mean, but nobody's data would actually end up in the wrong hands. And so this entire system was designed with these kinds of goals in mind. Another goal that we had was we wanted to avoid websites, and we wanted to avoid HTTP. And one of the reasons for doing that is, well, there are a couple reasons for doing that.
Oh, yeah.
One is that it's basically impossible to secure HTTP. As soon as you go to HTTPS, now you have, you know, enter the certificate mafia and enter, you know, man-in-the-middle attacks and all sorts of, you know, things. And we've actually seen some adventure with this recently. Mm-hmm. The people who hacked in, what was it, Google and Yahoo login and so on.
Yeah.
And we're potentially in a position to capture everybody's login information and so on. This is, you know, it seemed to us that HTTP is sort of, a Gen 1 type of technology, like having an account-based payment system. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is, I was looking at other protocols that we might use, and I went to xmpp.org, and xmpp is Jabber, which is an open source next generation instant messaging protocol.
Right.
And I was just amazed at how many different extensions there are to xmpp. The way XMPP works is that we're getting a little bit technical here, but there are some, they're what are called IQ packets or info query packets, and it's basically a request reply. And it's all based on top of XML, and so you basically send an XML object asking a question or setting some data or whatever, and you get a reply back. Well, in part of these, as part of the specification of the IQ packets, you can have what's called a child packet or an extension packet that goes in there.
Uh-huh.
And it's a payload essentially. And in that you can put any well-formed XML that you want, and you can define your own namespaces with your own, you know, series of messages. And people have done this for hundreds of different purposes.
Right.
And so I thought, well, what would happen if we just defined a suite of messages that would be all the messages that we'd need for a client to talk to servers.
Right.
And to, conduct whatever business we wanted to do with a payment. Well, this actually turned out not to be all that hard, and so we went down that route. And another reason why XMPP is probably, at least at present, is a superior idea is that it would be a lot harder to DDoS. Every system, every computer system in the world has the ability to send HTTP packets. I mean, I don't imagine you could even get a computer that couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Sure.
You said it would be difficult to DDoS or something. What was the word you used?
DDoS, distributed denial of service attack.
Okay. It didn't
come across. Because if you think about botnets, you have 50,000 computers in a botnet someone controls. They can bury an HTTP website with requests, but they could only do that with a XMPP server if every machine in their botnet had XMPP clients loaded on it, and I don't actually think that they do at this point.
There's
plenty out there.
They could. There's just one thing that on a previous show we just did with the Bitcoin Global Stock Exchange. I was talking about them the same exact setup. That if they were to go with a protocol that was not relying on just only SSL transport encryption, but they actually went with encryption that happens at the message-based level, they would be able to wrap their client and their server through XMPP, exactly like you're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, one thing that you can do with that, and I think you guys are actually doing something like that, is that let's say that there's 100 or something, and I think there are probably 100 Jabber servers out there that are public and private that have free accounts, okay?
Sure.
If you are a server, you can register for free automatically, okay, with a little list of all the servers, your daemon. You're sitting there listening at all of these addresses, accepting connections. If someone was going to do a denial of service, they'd have to do a DDoS on all 100 Jabber servers, including the Jabber servers that are run by Gmail and Google. So,
right.
you're just really, really getting a little deep in the system there. So, anyway, continue.
Anyway, we thought that this was a better, more extensible technology. And that didn't have some of the limitations that are found in your typical web-based payment system. And it's a little bit of a different world to deal with that. One of the areas where we expect that you sort of can't please everybody is in the area of the client. And so we had the notion all the way along that the client would have to be open source, or would have to at least be published source. Yeah, a lot of people sort of conflate those two terms. Open source means that anybody can basically check out source code and mess with it. And if you're dealing with a wallet application that deals with someone's money, you probably don't actually want that. But because you never know what somebody might be inserting. But if you're talking about published source, the reason why you'd have published source, even if there's a small number of hands that are stirring the pot, you do want to have published source, because that allows someone to make sure there are no back doors. You know, people can read the code and say, okay, this client looks clean. But even apart from that, we don't anticipate being able to write all of the clients. Uh-huh. Or any client on any device that anybody might want. So what we started with is there's two, or maybe two and a half clients at this point. There's a Java web app, which you can start in a browser. All you have to do is have Java loaded on your box. And that actually installs itself, so you have your own little VoucherSafe icon on your desktop and so on. And it'll update itself automatically if the installed executable changes. It's just a jar file, basically. And then the second client we have is actually in a plugin for a fairly popular Java client called Spark, and it has a plugin architecture. And basically, the way that works is that you have your regular Java client, so you could be logged into any Java server, and you're talking to various people, and you have a special tab that is your voucher safe, and on that tab is basically essentially the same thing. This is what you would see if you were just using the regular client. The difference between the two clients is that the first client, the web app, only does voucher safe. In other words, it is not actually a Java client. You can make payments, you can log into your safes, you can create safes, you can recover safes, you can do all the different things that you can do with the client, but you can't actually chat with it. With the Spark client, you can. So you could actually be chatting with the person that you're paying. And that's actually fairly useful. The second, or the sort of half client, is there's a command line client. And that is mainly it's something we developed internally because we need to be able to do load testing. In other words, you have to be able to run a whole bunch of users, simulate users making payments, and find out what happens when things time out or when something disconnects, or because the system is extremely distributed. I mean, we haven't really gone into the architecture of the system, but it's got about five different boxes that are on different continents that are actually involved in processing your transactions. And so it being that distributed, you have to be able to test it. And so that's what the command line client is. There's a harness that actually drives command line clients to do load testing.
Okay. Let me jump in here. All of these, the plugin, the Java, of course, is Java, and then the command line, are all of these systems based on Java, right?
Yes, they're all based on Java. Okay. And we felt that was a reasonable way to go, simply because it gets you at least three, it gets you Linux, it gets you Windows, and it gets you Mac, so that you can run on all three of those basic systems without a whole lot of users having to know how to install things.
Okay. Now, on the Java Web Start app, is it fairly easy for you to take that same, I guess you said it's like a jar, and run that separately, so you're not starting this thing all the time from within a browser?
Oh, absolutely. When you install it on your desktop, it just comes up without the browser after that.
Okay, that's fine.
You really only need the browser just to access it the first time to install it.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's back up here about 10,000 miles and go up to what you say in here, the orbit, a view from the orbit of the system and its components. And, oh, by the way, listeners, go to www.voucher-safe.org, create an account, and check out the information on there. You can start with the page that has these sections, which are kind of be topics that we're going to cover. It has system architecture and nomenclature, why it's good, what the system does, the implementation strategy, how the system works, and deployment plans. Some of those sound the same, but they hit from very different angles. We're going to hit at this one. The system architecture, when you look at this thing, it's quite mind-blowing, not because it's complicated, but because it's very fascinating. So let's start at the top. I'm not going to go through the diagram necessarily, but we're going to go through the different parts. The issuer. Tell us what these are the different parts of the system. What's the issuer?
Well, the issuer is basically the bailee who's holding the assets. And any kind of asset could be voucherized or could be turned into digital cash with a digital representation. I suppose you could even do that with bitcoins, although since that's already a digital object, I'm not sure why you would. But it would probably be something like USD or euros or gold or silver or something that's, you know, somewhere there's a vault with a pile of $100 bills in it or a pile of gold bars or a pile of something. And this is the person, the party that controls that pile of assets is the issuer.
Okay.
And what we've done is separate the function of the issuer from the voucher publisher. It's really kind of impossible to talk about the issuer without talking about the VP voucher publisher at the same time. Okay. And what the voucher publisher does is that's basically just a voucher factory that signs vouchers. And the issuer basically is in charge of keeping the backing assets and making sure that the total of all vouchers which are issued against that pile of assets never exceeds the value of the assets, so that an issuer only knows about amounts and voucher serial numbers, and that's it. It knows that there's, you know, so many $100 bills, there's so many, you know, $50 vouchers, there's $10 vouchers, there's whatever, you know, size vouchers they are. And, of course, they don't have to be in even denominations. You know, we're talking floating point math, okay? So you have a pile of assets that are voucherized, and the voucher issuer knows about the amounts and serial numbers of all of the vouchers that exist. And when someone makes a payment, what's really happening is one or more old vouchers are being exchanged for one or more new vouchers. And typically one goes to the payee and the other one is a change voucher that goes back to the payer.
Okay, so if the issuer is actually watching his database, and let's say that there's he's looking at this one voucher at the end of the database that's for 1,000 grams, and then he refreshes, he goes, gets a cup of coffee, and he comes back, and that voucher's gone, and there's 10 new vouchers there at 100 grams each in his balance.
Right, and that's entirely possible.
And that's all he sees.
And that's all he sees. He never sees a voucher safe. He has no idea of voucher safes. He doesn't know any of the people that are doing anything. He has absolutely no knowledge of that whatsoever.
Okay.
And one of the reasons why this divide absolutely has to be there is because the reality of operating an issuer is that you have to have a KYC regime. That is know your customer.
Right.
You can't just have, you know, you can't, the issuer is sort of like the bank, or the issuer is somebody who holds assets. I mean, if you think a good analogy for something that could be an issuer might be a bullion vault, for example, if you're familiar with how that works. It isn't a payment system. You know, one person who has an account at bullion vault can't pay another. There's no mechanism for doing that, but all the people who do have accounts there are identified. And so who would have an account at the issuer and actually be able to transfer voucher value to, say, wire transfers in fiat currency or whatever? And the answer would be an exchanger. You have to have an ability to get money in or out of the voucher system. Otherwise, it's not terribly useful.
Okay, just a moment. Let's back up here. So the issuer, and this is related to what you're talking about, the issuer, let's say he takes a gold bar, a kilo bar, and he says, "I'm going to be an issuer. Here's my kilo bar." Does he issue a voucher for 1,000 grams of gold and then give that to the voucher publisher?
No. What would happen is that there's a process called in-bail and out-bail. Mm-hmm. A voucher would be created because somebody who has an account with the issuer says, you have stored for me a 1,000 gram bar, and I want you to issue me a voucher payable to this voucher safe.
Okay.
For my gold. And so the issuer does that, and that request originates from the issuer and goes to the voucher publisher and basically says, send this guy a voucher in this amount, and here's the voucher serial number that you want to use for that. The voucher publisher then essentially will sign that voucher, will generate the voucher, signs it with its own private key, and then it doesn't have any ability to access someone's voucher safe. So what it does is, because the person has to be logged in order to get their public and private key pair. So what it does is it puts a notification elsewhere in the system on the little box called DHT, your distributed hash table, which we haven't come to yet. But it would basically put a notification there, and then when the person goes to log into their voucher safe, they'll see, oh, I have an incoming voucher. And then they pick that voucher up and it goes into their safe. And at that point, you've essentially minted the gold into vouchers. And there is, of course, a reciprocal process where someone could say, I want to spend a voucher and I want to have it go back to the issuer, and I want the issuer to credit my gold account at the issuer. And that is how vouchers are created and destroyed, or how value is put into the system and out of the system. And at that, you may have noticed that at this point, the issuer does know the voucher safe that it told the voucher publisher to send the initial voucher to when it was doing the bailment.
Right.
And that's why the people who are at the, have accounts at the issuer end, the expectation is that they're going to be fully identified and that they will have a voucher safe, which is they'll have an account at the issuer, and their voucher safe will be known to the issuer. Now, that doesn't mean that the first thing they can do when they get their issued voucher is spend it somewhere else, because once that voucher is issued, it circulates in the wild.
Yeah.
And it can go around in any number of voucher safes, and the person that ultimately redeems it and says, I want my gold, can be a completely different person. There's nothing that says it has to be the same person.
Right.
And so what this is an attempt to address, I should probably talk about something that we noticed. There was a couple of years ago in Europe, there was a conference, an international conference, on anti-money laundering. And this was all the people from law enforcement from around the world. And they got together to listen to a presentation about how you were going to deal with all of these sort of second realm type things, virtual worlds and MMOs and all these different kinds of things like Second Life and different things where there's money that's some kind of value that's circulating within a closed community. And how do you deal with that from an AML perspective? So, of course, our little ears pricked up when we heard this and said, well, how do they expect to deal with it? And
guns.
It was kind of surprising. Guns, yes. It was kind of surprising what the response was. And the strategy was basically, within the virtual world itself, anything goes. But where we have to drop the hammer is on the interfaces.
Yeah, at the borders. This is what we were talking
about. At the borders. Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you think about it as digital cash, that absolutely makes sense, because they're talking about using the same strategy as is used with cash.
Exactly.
When someone cashes a check at the bank, you get bills, they circulate in the wild, and then when somebody takes the bills and puts them back in the bank, at that point they have to account for the source of funds.
Right.
And so it's at the interface. So you can sort of think of the issuer as being like the bank. It's where the value is stored, and it's where when value is added or removed, it has to be done in a manner where everybody is fully identified.
Right, okay.
However, if you look at the Gen 1 payment systems, and the DGCs that we're all used to, they combined those two things. They were both the bank and the place where all the cash was exchanged.
Right.
And that proved to be fatal. And you absolutely can't do that. And of course, if you do the opposite, if you do that, what gold money has done, for example, which is that they have this very detailed customer acceptance policy, and it's very much like opening a bank account in a foreign country. And you have to go through all this, showing ID and notarized passport photos and all this kind of thing to get approved for your account. Well, this is perfectly practical if what you want to do is basically just hold bullion. But if all you want to be is a casual user, make some payments and have some anonymity, it's obviously completely broken.
Right.
And because you not only do you give up your anonymity when you go through this policy, but it's a lot of hassle. I mean, you have to take a whole bunch of documents and bundle them up and send them by, FedEx.
Right.
And most people in a second world, second realm type of context are probably not going to want to do that. Either they're not going to want to give up the data or they're not going to want to go through the hassle.
Yeah.
And so you sort of have to be able to say, if I just want to be a user of voucher safes or I just want to be able to send voucher payments around the world, I don't want to have to do any of those things. I just want to be able to create a key pair and I'm off and running.
Right.
And in fact, that's the way it works. So within the world itself, if you think of all the users of a voucher safe system as, a second realm a community that's circulating value among themselves,
mm-hmm.
Then that's fine. They can do that anonymously. The people who wouldn't be anonymous, and this of course is what brings us back to the concept of exchangers, because the exchanger is the person who's the gatekeeper at the border. And when somebody actually wants to redeem their vouchers for, whatever the underlying asset is or has the underlying asset and wants to, get it into voucher form, they need to be able to deal with someone who can sit on that fence. And that's the role for exchangers. And of course, there are rules depending on where the exchanger is located and so on that they may have to deal with, for their customers. And that's, that's sort of an exercise for the customer and the exchanger to work out.
Right.
It depends on who they are and where they are and, so on.
Right. Well, one thing here I'll bring up is that for users that don't see this image, on the big diagram you have here, under the location where you have issuer, you actually have listed there in parentheses Pecunix.
So yes, and that's because Pecunix is actually interested in converting users over to a voucher safe type of system. This may appear to be a little bit less urgent today than it did, but when that diagram was drawn and when this whole thing sort of started was in the aftermath of the takedown of eGold. And it's sort of, Pecunix is still operating without a rigorous know your customer regime in place. They don't have the regime that gold money does. And they're sort of twisting in the wind in that regard. And I think, and I think they probably think so too.
Well, yeah.
And it hasn't been an issue, but it's only because the system is small enough and does a small enough volume of payments that it's sort of off the radar or not really worth the effort to take down.
Right, but if you move into a system like this from Pecunix, you're getting the users are getting protected from the system.
Exactly, exactly, and the system is also getting protected from the users. Exactly,
uh-huh.
Right, and because you see, you have to separate the minting function from the payment system.
Yeah.
If you don't do that, you have these huge legal liabilities, and so naturally, when that diagram was written, the question was asked, who would be an issuer? Who would be storing gold or whatever it is? And Pecunix came up because, they can't leave the system like it is.
Yeah, right.
And as a matter of fact, the system has been left like it is for the past couple of years. But that's not something you can just leave dangling indefinitely. And,
right.
And so that is something that would be changed at some point in the future. But I'm not Pecunix. I don't. Have any ability to speak for them. So.
Right. But one thing that they do have is a reputation, and they have a solid reputation among users that use the system, and their reputation is great for people trusting that they actually do have the gold not sitting, you know, in a little vault right next to where the server is, but in a safe location, and it's being accounted for, and
but it's being audited by a party and so
right.
on. Yeah.
So they already have this fantastic infrastructure for them. They're not just like some company that just throws up a fancy website like that sham of Liberty Reserve. And then everybody just kind of like goes with the bells and whistles. Pekinix already has that. So then moving into a system like this, they're not just starting from scratch as a provider of this service. And it's not just a piece of software. It's actually an entire infrastructure.
Right.
Now, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to say that the system is architected in such a way, and a lot of is obvious complexity. There's reasons for that complexity, and the reason for it is that it's architected in such a way that every component could be dishonest, and it wouldn't hurt anything. Mm-hmm. In other words, if somebody were compromised, or if somebody's server got hacked, or what have you, it wouldn't actually be fatal. It wouldn't compromise the user's privacy. It wouldn't destroy anything, right? There are, however, two points at the opposite ends where trust is necessary. One of them, of course, is the issuer. You have to be able to trust, if you're dealing in vouchers, that there really is a pile of gold or whatever it is somewhere, and it really is audited by a third party, and that issuer really is reliable, and that you really do have the ability to, if you want to redeem it, you absolutely can.
Right.
And if you don't have that confidence, then there's no reason to accept the vouchers as payment for anything. And then the second place where some trust is required is all the way at the other end, at the client, because you have to trust that the client is honest and the client isn't broadcasting a log of all of your transactions to somebody who has no right to see it, for example. And that concern can be addressed by open source. Or by publishing the source for the clients.
Right.
And we expect that at some point there will be clients for smartphones, for iPads, for all sorts of things that we haven't written yet, and probably we won't be responsible for writing all of those things for the simple reason that it's impossible to anticipate what kind of a design, no matter how much feedback you get from people, it's impossible to anticipate what's going to be the killer app. Can't write the killer app on every possible device that's out there. So is there a room for open source development to write clients? Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, it's not something we could prevent, because the servers, as long as they're getting well-formed XMPP packets that have the right fields in them and that parse correctly and so on, as long as the protocol is being obeyed, the system has no ability to even tell one client from another.
Right, exactly.
You wouldn't know what client somebody was using. But there is a concern for users to know that the source has been, for the client they're using, is secure and has been, at least read by somebody else, if not by them.
Right. Yeah. And the Java Web Start thing, when you first run that, real quick, and it installs on your desktop. From then on, it never runs from your – whenever you click on that URL. Or what about updates? You said it does automatic updates.
It basically – Java web start launches are smart enough to notice that if the jar file on the server – I mean, it knows where it came from, basically.
Oh, okay.
And that jar file is signed by a developer key. So you can tell if the key changes, it'll put something up that says, hey, wait a minute, this is no longer signed by the same people.
Yeah, well, because of what happened with Hush and the ability for people for someone to put a gun to somebody's head on the server, even if they signed it with their signature on an update,
a lot of
people would want to compile it and look at the source that has and compile the source that is signed and have that reviewed,
right.
Then run that and never run it from the web and always run it locally. And then if they update their client to the next version, they want to check it from there.
Would do the same thing. Exactly.
Right.
And there's nothing that would stop you from doing that.
Right.
I mean, you can download the source, just to download the zip file for the source. There's a simple build prescript thing. You just say amp jar and amp does the rest and builds it for you. Now, there are some other components that you do have to put in there. There are a number of jar files that, you know, deal with parsing the XMPP, XML pull parsers, and, you know, document object management, and, you know, so you've got a number of different you know jar files that it's built on top of, and those are just sort of part of the build. You'd have to have those in your library directory in order to actually compile the source.
Okay. What about the API? Is that published, or do you have any libraries, or is it just
yes? It's if you go to the vouchersafe.org, all the Java docs are there. The source is there, and there's also a list of all of a definition of all of the IQ extensions and all the message definitions that were used throughout the system.
Okay. Do you have
talks about the server to server ones and not just the client to server ones.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Do you have a library possibly that's easy to just grab and start doing some Java stuff with, or somebody would just have to get the source and just use one of your internal?
Yeah, you'd pretty much have to get the source and start playing around with it.
Okay.
Probably the first thing, the place to start if you wanted to, you know, write your own client or something, the place to start would be to figure out how the existing client works.
Yeah.
Again, it's not that hard. It's and everything is you know, there are Java docs for all of it. So you have the API is completely documented.
Yeah. I see many people. From that. Yeah, I'm sorry. There's a delay that we have in the thing, so we keep bumping into each other. The thing that I see a lot of people doing, not necessarily at the beginning, making a graphical user interface client, but there's some people that would want to integrate like a shopping cart interface or some other type of automation or back-end integration system into it.
Well, I can talk about that a little bit. We actually did that. I mean, I wrote something that was, I just, you know, threw together some PHP code, and what it would do is, if somebody were doing an order on a website, it basically encrypts that order symmetrically and then takes the order details and sends it in an XMPP message to the user's Jabber client. They'd have to put their Jabber ID in. And it then when they receive that message, the client will basically populate the payment form with all of the baggage fields that had to do, you know, with customer order numbers and shipping address or, you know, whatever other things might be there. And that way, when the merchant gets their payment, it would have all of the website data in it so that they could distinguish, you know, which customer this was and so on.
Okay.
And that actually works. The code that the person would need to put into, the user would need to put in to decrypt the message from the website would be generated in a JPEG file, kind of like a Turing number. It would be displayed on the website, and then they put that and then type that in their voucher client, and it would, you know, decrypt the message, and then they could make their payment to the website. That part of it works fine. The problem that you have is, again, as I said at the beginning, we have a limitation of cache. And the only way that the website could do the back-end processing is if it were, you know, using the command line client or something to go log into the voucher safe and pick up the incoming payment and parse it and look at it and say, okay, yeah, this is for this order, and then do the back-end processing to fulfill the order. But the implication of that is that the web server would have to have all of the login credentials for the voucher safe. Well, you know, that would be a terrible idea because anyone who could hack into the web server could get those credentials and steal all the merchant's money.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this needs a little bit more thinking.
Well, we talked about this with the Loom system. We talked about in the Loom API about the ability of people to just go in and hack the server and sweep out the account. And what the idea we came up with was just to have payments all go to a particular account, and then when the web server would do very minimal stuff up front, and it would either queue stuff that would be pulled out by another off-site processor, and there that would move stuff between accounts and do all of the heavy work, but it would only be a temporary thing that would be held on the main server, and in that account there would never be any more than a temporary transaction. And then also generating brand new IDs, like giving a different payment location for every single user that comes in. There's little things that
right
you can do. Well, we've gotten off on a little bit of some great technical stuff. Let's back up a little bit on the issuer. Right now, inside of your system, okay, you have a bunch of test currencies right now. Let's say, when is this software ready to go? Is it beta stage? How close are you to telling an issuer this is ready?
I think we'll probably have, the plan is that we'll have the first issuer, first live issuer, probably by around the end of this month.
Okay. So
you know, probably within like about a month, we'll be taking the beta label off the client and actually having not just, you know, funny money that's going around that's, you know, test euros or whatever, uh-huh. but actual actual test or actual, you know, real value. I mean, we think it's ready in that sense. The system is quite robust, and we still have some testing to do to determine maximum user loads. But quite frankly, if based on the testing so far, if we were actually maxing out the network and you know, maxing out the CPU of the various components, we'd be making so much money that the system would be earning so much money, doing so many payments per second that it would be. Not a problem at that point to be buying hardware or adding network bandwidth or whatever it is it was necessary to do it. I should probably mention
we would all love to have.
right, and where you're mugged by your success. Well, remember, there was a time when it was almost impossible to get a payment to go through on eGold because they were just hammered. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was I can remember back in those days you'd submit your payments and just hope that it would actually come back and not time out on you because it would. Typically time out, you know, and it was, and so we're trying to avoid that kind of thing and say, well, we want to make sure that we're designing ahead of any possible capacity. And I should probably point out that the entire system has been designed in such a way that every, it's similar to Loom in that there are usage tokens that pay for operations. And those tokens are accrued by all of the objects, all of the various components that are in the distributed architecture. They basically all get paid in tokens. And so that has a couple of implications. One of them is that you can't have an issuer that the system, the operators of the system servers aren't willing to be paid in. Okay, so if you, because when they redeem the tokens that they've been paid, they turn into vouchers, right? So they become, they're basically being paid in any asset type that's circulating. And this is one of the things that we felt was very important in the design is to make sure that each of the components was a potential profit center, because what you're basically doing when you see this as a sort of a tragedy of the commons problem with Tor. People don't want to run exit nodes because there's a lot of demand on their bandwidth, and there's a lot of risk involved in that, because if somebody's doing something nefarious, it's going to look like it's being done from their server and so on. And so you have this issue where what you are essentially doing, and, you know, we'll maybe move to a little bit of a philosophical, you know, viewpoint here, or political viewpoint. What this system is basically doing, and what Second Realm technologies in general are doing, is giving economic freedom and privacy to slaves. And the ruling master class is not going to appreciate that. And so what you need to do if you're going to have a system that is giving freedom to slaves is you need to be able to be compensated for doing that. I mean, if you are taking risks to help people, they need to be able to pay you for that. And so, you know, I'll make no bones about it. The system was designed with the intention of being a profit center, of making money, not necessarily, you know, for the you know, people who are doing the coding, but for the people that are operating the system and operating the servers. And so what we envision is that there's sort of a franchise model. And as the system grows and as more issuers get added and more voucher publishers get added, most of these different components have sort of a many-to-one mapping that they can support, you know, one or at least one or more of other of the other components. And so it's possible as the network expands that each one of these servers, as there's demand for it, you know, it will support another server. And, right. and that it basically allows the thing to sort of, you know, grow over time. And all of the servers that we have are all connected on a VPN. So what is actually happening is that you're sending encrypted packets over a connection secured by TLS over a VPN with IPsec. So you've actually got three levels of encryption on all of the server-to-server stuff. And I think that's probably and that also has a little bit of a of an implication for defeating traffic analysis as well, particularly when there's other traffic on the VPN that has nothing to do with the voucher safe system.
Yeah. Well, everything you're talking about sounds like there's a as opposed to Tor, there's an economic incentive for someone to
right.
jump
well,
in.
We felt.
Do it. Go ahead.
We felt that the system architecture had to reflect the economic reality of the situation. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. What we want is we want something that is going to be sustainable and that every server that comes online will be able to pay for itself, pay for the server, pay for the bandwidth that's used, pay for the, you know, the cost of having someone admin that server and so on.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let's talk real quick. We're coming up on an hour here. We may go a little bit over, but I think we're going to need to split this up because there's just a mountain of wonderful little things that the system is doing. Back to the issuer. Is the initial issuer is that public information on who and what form of currency is being?
As much as a purist gold, hard money, objective value advocates would like, it's probably not going to be gold. It's probably going to be a fiat currency. And I would guess either U.S. dollars, euros, or both.
Okay. Do you know... Go ahead.
So I was going to say, I don't know what it's going to be called. And I don't know exactly, you know, the logistics of how it's going to work, but there will basically be, I guess you could say that what's happening here is that all of the problems that are coming to a head with Liberty Reserve are creating a market opportunity for somebody else to come in and do it better.
Right, okay.
And, you know, without doing all this KYC regime on all of the customers and without doing, you know, all the issues that are coming up there. And I think that fact as another thing which is operating is the recent stuff that we've probably all heard about or a lot of people have heard about anyway about the war on online poker and online gambling and so on. It's getting obvious, I would think, to these people and to other people around the world that you really do need a second realm. You can't just do whatever you want in the banking system because there's always some bureaucrat somewhere who doesn't, you know, think that that's okay or who wants to be able to, you know, use a pretext to go jump in there and seize your operation and take all your money or whatever. And so you've got all these looters who are trying to, you know, put their fingers in those pies and take whatever they can out of it. And so for all of these different kinds of reasons, there really is a significant market opportunity
right.
for basically having fiat currency that's circulating outside the banking system.
So
I think honestly, I mean, I'm not a fan of fiat currency, and I would love to see you know something like you know a pecunix or you know next generation, and that would be where we go. But realistically, if you want to have any substantial amount of users, you have to, you know, it's not for you to dictate what is value and what is, you know, going to be, you know, the first issuer on philosophical grounds. The market is going to dictate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, if there's a market opportunity there, then they can just go ahead and become the next another issuer.
That's right.
Their goal.
That's right.
Which is my next question. What's the bar to entry for getting in the voucher safe system as an issuer?
Well, the bar to entry is that the voucher publisher has to be willing to accept you as an issuer. And the main, you know, there's two criteria there. One is, again, all the voucher publisher and the other system entities have to be willing to be paid in tokens that are redeemable in your asset type. So, I mean, that's sort of a validity screen right there. I mean, anybody can't be an issuer. I mean, I'm not, you know, meaning to criticize the way Patrick has done Loom, but in Loom, anyone can define an asset type. In this, and then, you know, just it's up to them to try and convince people that that's a valid asset and that they should accept it. We can't be quite that casual about it in this system. There has to be, for example, accountability and auditability. You have to be able to show that there's a third party audit that says that, you know, your issuer is really there, because there is a certain, you know, reputational bind between, you know, if you create safes on a particular voucher publisher's network, and some of the issuers on there turn out to be, you know, Ponzi schemes or counterfeit or, you know, not real or something, it would damage the reputation of all the other issuers as well.
Right. I understand.
And so you do have to, so, you know, there is a little bit of a bar there. I know that there are, I mean, I don't think, is for the reasons that you mentioned earlier, I don't think the Kunix would have a problem with that. I don't think that some other credible organizations like the Global Settlement Foundation, you know, wouldn't have any trouble doing that. You know, but it's got to be some kind of a viable organization that is willing to, you know, present some bona fides. And at that level, I think the voucher publisher, you know, can hardly have anonymous issuers. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. It's sort of a, because there's a business relationship there.
Okay. So if people want to get involved with this project, like talking about it, learning about it, finding out how they can become an issuer, they can go ahead and go to the voucher-safe.org site and join up in the forum and start contacting.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That would be the place to go. I think there's actually a forum for, you know, business ideas or business discussions or something of that sort. And of course, you know, obviously there, you know, people may want to deal, you know, pseudonymously, or, you know, put a post that says contact me offline or something. I mean, I don't know that you'd really want to conduct a business negotiation in a public forum, but that would be a good starting point. There's also a website which we should mention that's voucher-safe.com.
Right.
As opposed to .org. And what this is this is intended to be a website that's more of a, you know, let's skip all the technical stuff. Let's skip the business discussion. I just want to be a user and I want to get started with it. I want to learn how to use it. I want to learn how to use my safe and do all these different functions. And so there's a bunch of video tutorials, which were not done by me. They were done by another person involved with the project. And all of those are, you know, they're screenshot videos that are done that show you how to use, you know, screencast. Yeah. And they show you how to do everything. And that's also a place where you can download the client and get it installed. And it shows you how to do that and all that stuff. So if you're interested in getting involved with the project, that use the .org. If you just want to be a user, use the .com. That would be my advice.
Right. And if they get an account on the forum, they can ask you for some funny money tokens and assets to trade around, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's a forum post for that. In fact, even the VoucherSafe.com thing has a related forum. There's a help and support link which takes you to I think it's VoucherSafe.freeforums.org, which is just some PHPBB software or something that does some basic forums, and you can ask in there as well.
Okay, great. Now, I think we're going to close up here, because if we start getting into some of the other stuff here, we'll easily go another half hour and more on this, and I want to keep it closer to an hour. We've covered some good topics. Well, let me go through these other topics, because this is going to be a nice little tease for some of the listeners. We on this overview page, we cover a little bit about the issuer and then the voucher publisher, then some of the other areas we could get into. The secure data store is a place to store voucher, tokens, payments, receipts, and the like. And you have up here, this is the secure data store. It's called the SDS, and you have stuff listed in here. It's persistent, and you have some ideas about Tahoe and Ocean Store and how you are using some of that stuff, and you're using some stuff for doing your things, and other stuff just didn't work out, like Tahoe didn't work out for some stuff. We're going to cover that in the next show. The distributed hash table, DHT, it's a place to store temporary data, and it is used as an out-of-band communications medium for messages between voucher safes, the VP and the VS, and like the SDS, the DHT also earns token for each record it stores. Wow, so then we get into the public key server. It's a repository for a public key certificate of each voucher safe and existent, and the CRLs, which is great. Open upon which revoked certificates are placed into when safes are closed. All kinds of stuff happen in there. Then the OpenFire servers themselves that are taking care of exchanging and routing these messages between all of the different systems. And then the last part, which is what we talked about a little bit today, which was the voucher safe client. And we didn't even get into the actual operation of it. But I suggest everybody check out the screencasts. They're excellent because they just go through all the basic operations for just a regular user on sending and receiving payments back and forth. And that was just the voucher architecture system as a whole. And then there's just a lot of information that we're going to talk about in future shows. So those are a little bit of tease information. So thank you very much, Mr. Voucher Developer, Voucher Safe Developer. For coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. I think what we're dealing with here is something that is intended to be sort of a commercially ready product at this point, or very shortly. So it's not a toolbox. It's intended to be, you know, something that's at a fairly complete level of development, and that is, we think, ready for it to, you know, actually start handling people's money. And so I think it would be good for people to, you know, get acquainted with it before they decide that that's something that they wanted to use. And in terms of how it's going to be used in the commercial world, I mean, right now I honestly couldn't tell you. As you pointed out at the beginning of the show, this frontier in the second realm is wide, wide open at this point. There are so many new tools and new technologies that are coming out, and it's impossible to know, you know, where it's going to go from here. All sorts of things are going to happen that we didn't anticipate, and that's actually good, because that allows for the market of the second realm to actually be making the choices as to what's most useful as freedom-enabling technologies.
Everyone, voucher-safe is here. So check it out and stay tuned. Hopefully, I'll work with you offline on the next show, maybe within a week. Hopefully, we could do another show. It would be good timing to follow up on this. And thank you
very
much.
Okay, well, I'd be glad to do that.
Oh, super. And thank you very much for all of the hard work that you've done on this project, too. Not just coming on the show, man. That's fantastic. So,
well, it's been about 2 years in development, but we're finally getting to the point where we're ready to go live with the system.
Fantastic.
All right, thanks again for having me on the show.
Yep, you bet.
And I look forward to seeing you again.
Sounds great. Thanks. Me too. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Wow, great stuff, man. We're just getting plumbled here with this fantastic technology. As he said, all this Second Realm stuff is on fire right now. Well, we're going to leave you out here with, and again, you know it, the Crystal Method. Now is the time.
deserves to climb.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.